Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. There's a new addition to the popular Midfort novel series, and we're going to be talking with the author today, Larry Mueller here. Thanks again for joining us. Our guest, Jan Caron, is the author of the New York Times bestselling Midfort novels featuring Episcopal priest Father Timothy Cavanaugh. Her latest in the series is titled To Be Where You Are. You may be a fan of Jan Caron and of Midfort. Would you like to live in Midfort? What is it about the novels that draw you in? I hope you'll join in our conversation. Number to call 1-800-642-1234. You can send us an email at ideas@wpr.org, or you can also post on our Facebook page. Love to hear from you. And Jan Caron, welcome. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today.
Oh, good morning. I'm thrilled to be here and love my Wisconsin readers.
Well, I tell you what, you've got a lot of readers here in Wisconsin. And I've read a few of your books as well and have enjoyed them. And it was really interesting to me to see that you wrote your first novel at the age of 10.
Well, it was 14 pages long. Oh. With a pencil on lined blue horse and notebook paper, and of course my heroine had an 18-inch waistline just like Scarlett. So yeah.
Do you still have the original in your possession?
I wish I did. That would be fun. But no, I was standing at the wood stove when I asked my grandmother to burn it because I knew I could do better.
Oh boy! Well, it took you 40 years to get back to writing.
Well, something like that. I was writing all the time, though. Wow. I was in advertising, and I was always in the creative department. So I've been really writing most all of my life. But this is what I wanted to do. It's all I wanted to do. I knew at the age of 10 that I was going to be a writer. I just didn't have anything to say for a long time.
Well, I tell you what, it's got to be hard to leave a successful career. You had a great career. To turn to writing.
And the fact that it's my second career is kind of nice. Actually, a lot of fiction writers came out of advertising. Salman Rushdie, for example, James Patterson, Peter Mayle, Dorothy Sayers. I could go on. I mean, there's a huge list of us who came out of that field into this one.
And there's a type of writing in that field, I think, that can carry over well to novels.
I think so. Well, it taught me to get to the point and not waste time, not waste the reader's time, and have some fun, if at all possible, while doing it. And by the way, I have had a lot of fun in Midfort. Almost a quarter of a century of fun. It's so amazing that I've been writing these novels for about 25 years.
Yeah.
It's
amazing. For those who aren't familiar with Midfort, describe the town.
It's about 1,200 people. It swells to maybe 2,800 in the summertime when the Floridians come up to get cool. It's set in the mountains of North Carolina in the Blue Ridge, where I lived for a number of years. I am a North Carolinian, though I live in Virginia now. I hope that Midfort is a universal small town. I hear from people all over the country and actually from other places in the world who say it's just like their small town. So that's my hope, that that everybody can get it, whether you're from Wisconsin or California.
Yeah.
Or Singapore, even. I've heard from Singapore, South Africa, France. In fact, for a book event coming up in Asheville, North Carolina, on the 25th of October, one of my dear fans, loyal fans, will be flying from Paris to Asheville, North Carolina. She speaks French, she speaks German, and she reads my books in English.
Oh, what a wonderful story. You know, as in my other job as a professor here at the UW-Madison, I did a lot of community development research. So I looked at 40 or 50 small towns, or, you know, small to medium sized towns throughout Wisconsin. And you're right. A lot of what you write about that small town certainly mirrors what I saw a lot in my research. It's pretty cool.
Well, you know, we fly over a lot of small towns. We don't really, or we drive across the country and don't take all the exits. My daughter and I spent a lot of time 1 year in Kansas on a trip to Wyoming. We just kept taking exits. We didn't care what exit it was. We just took it. And we found all these wonderful, wonderful small towns. We ate in so many diners and little cafes and talked to the people. And when I travel, I don't like to go to the big cities. I want to go to the countryside. I want to go to the villages. I think that's where we find the heartbeat of who we are, really, is in the small towns.
And those cafes, or even the local bar, you know?
Absolutely. I want to go there, too.
Well, listen, we have callers who want to join in, and Betty's been waiting a while from Beaver Dam, so I want to get her involved here. Betty, thank you for calling.
Yes. She's my favorite author, and I've re-listened to her books several times. I love them in audio. And back when the travel ban was issued, my glass was three-quarters empty. I was down. And I saw that Come Rain or Come Shine was available again. I binge-listened, and you know what? I had my good cry when Jack Tyler appeared, and he cured me.
Well, I figure if I can't give you a good cry and a good laugh, I haven't done my job, Betty.
I think you're absolutely right. Betty, thank you so much for calling.
Thanks, Betty.
Talking about the town itself, here's an interesting question from Linda on Facebook. She said, Mitford is so idyllic, even though there's poverty and death. How would any of us fit into the town if we moved there? What would be expected of us? What could we expect of the current residents?
That's a really, really good question. I'm sorry?
It really is a great question, isn't it?
I've had a lot of questions. I've traveled and toured many, many years and never heard that one before. What could they, I would like to answer, what could they expect of you? And this is as profound an answer as I know to give. They would expect of you, or hope from you, that you would open your heart. Open your heart. If you go in shielded, guarded, armored, no, that doesn't work anywhere. Big city, small town, excuse me, nowhere. You go in with an open heart, and to have your heart open, you have to be unafraid. And it's hard to go in as a stranger to any town, any community, and be unafraid because everything's new. But you just go trusting God and trusting yourself. Trusting yourself. I mean, you're a lot of fun, whoever you are. Maybe you don't always know that.
Yeah.
But they want to see, they want to laugh with you. Yeah. And then if they can laugh with you, then they're going to be able to cry with you when you need it.
Yeah, so be yourself.
Yeah, yes, that's all we want from each other.
Tom in Burlington has a question for you, or comment. Hi, Tom.
I met Leo Tolstoy's son. I spent a whole afternoon with him. We were drinking sangria in Georgetown. I had an apartment in Georgetown that overlooked Avril Harriman's house, right on M Street there. And his grandson told me that his grandfather he didn't start writing until he was around 47 years old, and he wrote about people that he knew. And the mother, she did a lot of the editing. And then at a certain point, he left the wife. He went up to the Urals or something. He said, "We've been married 47 years, and this about it." But my question is, does someone really, when you get older, you have more to bring to the table than you would if you were younger. And a lot of the people you do write about, do you know those people and those characters that you write about?
Please state that question again. I didn't quite get.
I think he said that Tolstoy didn't start writing until he was 45.
Yes.
And wonders if writers have more to bring to the table if they start writing at a later point in time.
Well, I do feel so, yes. When I said earlier that I had nothing to say for a long time. In fact, I left advertising with the intention of writing a novel. I gave up everything, all the benefits, obviously, and I traded down to a car with rust on the fenders, which was very humiliating, and I took on quite a different lifestyle and sat down to write my novel and really literally found that I had nothing to say. It was so frightening because I hadn't burned my bridges exactly, but I knew that I wasn't going to look back. Yes. On another level of that question, when I started writing about Father Tim, again, almost a quarter of a century ago, I didn't even really like him very much. He was there and demanded to be heard and seen. I had to write it. I knew that. But it was like Agatha Christie said of her fellow, whose name right now, Poirot.
Poirot.
She said at the end, I never really cared for that little man. but as it turns out, as I grew and he grew, we grew together. And I came to not only like him very much, I just enjoyed his company. He can be amusing. He's really quite deep and profound, heartfelt. And I have grown to love him. And as this is my last Mitford novel, I will miss him profoundly.
Yeah, this is your last one.
Yes.
Oh.
Well, I have much more to do, but it's on another plane.
Oh, well, you went away from the Mitford novels for a while, too.
Well, I guess in the classic sense, yes. But I continued to write. I wrote something called the Father Tim novels, which simply took him away from Mitford.
Yeah.
But we've now folded those into the Mitford series, giving us 14 total.
Thanks again, Tom, for calling. We're visiting today with Jan Caron, novelist and the author of the Mitford series. And she has a New York Times bestseller on her hands right now, as she has with many of her other books. It's titled To Be Where You Are. What about you? Have a question for her, a comment about the series? I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or go ahead and post on our Facebook page. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. We're visiting with Jan Caron, author, novelist, and her latest in the Mitford series is titled To Be Where You Are. And once again, join in with your own questions or comments at 800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Certainly love to hear from you. Well, is there more of you in Father Tim or in Cynthia? Someone wanted to know.
Well, that's a really good question. And honestly, there's a lot of me in all of my characters, even in Miss Rose. I would love to dress like Miss Rose. Secretly, in my heart, I do dress like Miss Rose. But even Barnabas, even the behavior of the dog, and there are a lot of dogs in my work and a lot of cats, too. I love animals. And there's a big bull named Choo-Choo. I mean, you know, I go through a lot of animals in the books. And it is impossible to write a character without bringing yourself into it in some way. Often I'm asked if I model my characters on other people. And if I do, I'm unaware of it. But surely we do model our characters on others. But it's kind of like you pick the grapes, you put them in the tub, you jump in with your bare feet, and you start to mash up the grapes. Well, you can't tell where that grape came from or that grape came from. You just know they're all in there together. And that's sort of where the characters start coming out, is all that mush, that blend.
Well, you know, lots of people may think of Mitford as a perfect place, and but you don't shy away from bad things happening. And I'm and quite a few of the characters, for example, and pets, as you were just talking about, have died during the series, and that has to be difficult for you to do. I mean, I get tied up with the characters, and it's hard to let them go. And if, just for a reader, it must be really hard for you as a writer to let them go.
Well, Larry, you just hit the nail on the head. I am so, I don't even like to let my characters get the flu. I mean, but honestly, you just can't go on forever in this life. And I just had a death in to be where you are. And I disliked letting her go because she was a charming, eccentric, funny, quirky kind of character. But it was her time. I mean, it just was. And I loved the way I was led to handle her death. Now, when Miss Sadie died, and that was early on, I think it was in book three of the series, I grieved for her. I mean, I loved Miss Sadie. And I've heard from other, from readers, that they loved Miss Sadie, and they had their own grief period. I hated to let Barnabas go, but you know, he was 13 years old. He was a big dog. I mean, he's got to go, and there you have it. What can I say?
Oh, man. There's a great map of Mitford in the front of your books. I really like that. Is that something you just had in your mind in the beginning of the series?
Well, I didn't know it was going to be a series for quite a long time. After I finished the first book, I was stunned that I'd actually written a novel, although I'd moved to this little mountain town in order to do it. The fact that I actually accomplished it was phenomenal. But it took about three books to realize that I had a lot to say about this character and about this town. And so we kept going, and there you have it. But what was your question? I'm so sorry.
I was so taken up with what you were talking about that I forgot my own question.
The map,
that's right.
I started drawing a map so I would be able to see where he walked, where he jogged. We were jogging then, not running. And where his office was and where the church, all of that, it just became, I had to know where everything was. And if he turned right out of his house, where would that take him? So I do still have that original drawing. It appeared in the Mitford Bedside Companion, which was edited by my sister, Brenda Furman. I love the map, too. It's been through several iterations. This is the newest iteration. I like it best.
Yeah, I like it a lot. It just helps the reader sort of picture in their own mind where things, you know, where those things are in the town itself. And I think it actually helps the reader.
Larry, if I had nothing but money, and I'm talking big, huge money here, I would build a Mitford, and I would hire New York stage actors, for example, to come in. It would be sort of like a summer theater group. We would have a Dooley, and we would have him in various stages of his life. We'd have Father Tim. We'd have everybody, even the dead ones, depending on when you wanted to come, what period of time during the summer. And it would just be fun. You know, you go to the Main Street Grill, and then you go to Wanda's Feel Good Cafe, and I would love to go there.
Well, you kind of have.
I do. That's right. I sit there at the computer, and I go there, and I love it.
And you've gone to many other places. I mean, the town of Mitford in some ways has to be sort of the sum of the best parts of the towns and so forth that you visited and even lived in.
Well, I think that's a very astute observation. That's a wonderful observation. I think you're right, yes.
Diane in Appleton has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Diane. Thank you.
Hi. Thanks for taking that call. Jan, it's so wonderful to be talking to you. You have filled so many niches in people's lives. where no matter what we're going through, if we're going through a time of celebration, if we're going through a time of crisis, that with your little scriptures before your each chapter, you fit that need and give us people to love and care about.
Thank you, Diane. Thank you so much. How long have you been reading Mitford?
Golly, I think I started back in the, I forget. I've been retired, so time no longer matters. I started reading you on every break from my job, which was a really high-stress job, and I always said you were the Calgon Take Me Away book, because no matter what was going on, for that period of 15 minutes or half hour on lunch, you actually picked yourself up and you took yourself and put yourself down and you thought about Dooley and the dog and Father Tim, and it's like nothing else mattered because you had new people that you really could care about, that you felt like you had a relationship with. And I tell you, your cookbook was just so awesome. That was so ingenious of you to do that cookbook.
Oh, thank you. I love that you said that. I hired someone to do it because of my writing schedule. I didn't have time to test all those recipes. I would have had jumped out the window if I'd had to do that.
I'm still waiting to make that orange cake.
but I did write the essays, and they did photograph it in my home. So it was a very personal task that took 3 years, exactly 3 years, to bring that together.
It was just ingenious. And, you know, I think if people would go to incredible fiction like you, like yours, and also another one that I loved was the number one ladies detective agency, which also did that same kind of thing, where it gave you compassion for people that you didn't even know in a rather disjointed world. It really takes you away and brings you back where you see your own life in a different perspective.
Yes, I think so. And that also is a good observation, Diane, that it does help you see your own life in a different perspective, a better perspective, perhaps in some time.
You have taken a lot of money away from the counseling and psychiatric industry, because if you read your books, you will actually be able to come back and say, you know what, life is pretty darn good.
Diane, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Dan.
And, you know, she raises a few things that I wanted to follow up on, actually. The books themselves, they are written in such a way that adults and young readers can read those books without the fear of that a parent might have, for example, of language or the grim details of various things that could happen.
Well, I have the same reading demographic that Charles Dickens had, which is to say both sexes and all ages. Charles Dickens wrote for the family hearth, if you will. The father would bring home the latest supplement, which he would buy for a few quid. They'd stand in line. I don't remember now whether it came out every Tuesday or every other month or what. Anyway, people would line up. The men would bring the newspaper supplement with the Dickens story in it home to the family. He would read it first to see if there was anything that might unusually alarm the children. And then they would be seated after dinner in the parlor, and the father would read aloud to the family. So that's what I have always wanted. I've always wanted a family audience. I want you to be able to give a book to your Uncle John or your Aunt Margaret or your young mother in the family, to pass it on to your granddaughter. And sometimes we have four generations reading the books at the same time. So that is my hope, that my books will give a whole family something to talk about and get excited about together.
And you, I think, succeed in that very well. Diane also brought up the Esther's Orange Marmalade Cake.
Mm-hmm.
That's been a star since the first novel, I think. Where did that recipe come from?
That is such a great question. Larry, you are really good at this. Do do you interview authors all the time?
I have a chance to interview quite a few authors.
Okay, well, it shows. The orange marmalade cake did not have a recipe for a long time. I simply needed in this town to give it some balance. I needed a great baker. You know, almost every town has one or two or three. And so I thought, okay, what's she going to bake that makes her so popular? It's not chocolate because that's too easy. So I loved orange marmalade, still do, crazy about it, the rough cut variety. Let's have an orange marmalade cake. I'm not a cake baker. I had no idea how such a cake might be made. But anyway, I ran with it. People started wanting the recipe. I didn't have one. I became writer in residence for Victoria Magazine while it was owned by Hearst. And they went to Edna Lewis, who now deceased, a very, very famous chef, originally from Virginia, lived in Atlanta with a young chef named Scott Peacock. I just saw him again very recently.
Oh.
The two of them got together in their Atlanta kitchen, and they designed, made up, the orange marmalade cake recipe, and it just went viral. It's all over the Internet. It is the best cake I have ever put in my mouth, bar none. But it's so hard to bake, you could not pay me cash money to do it.
I wondered. That was my next question. Is it as hard to make as you describe it? I'm not a baker. I love to cook, but I'm not a baker. And that one looked hard to make as far as I was concerned.
Well, it's hard to make. It really is. But people do it all the time. And they send pictures, post pictures of their cakes on Facebook and on my page. And by the way, I hope your wonderful Wisconsin readers will come to my Facebook page and say hello. Love to see you there.
Yeah, and give us your Facebook page, by the way.
I just think it's Jan Caron.
I think you're right. We have links to your book and to your pages on our Facebook page.
Yeah, and there's a website and the whole thing.
Yeah.
We have more fun on the Facebook page. The website is just sort of there for information, I think.
The Facebook page, definitely more fun, I think, in that respect. Well, I tell you what, the current book, you've moved from focus on Father Tim to focus on Dooley and Lace. And why did you decide to do that, or why did you decide it was time to do that?
Well, actually, I disagree somewhat. I'm focusing on both families. You see, they get equal time.
Yeah.
One chapter is Mitford, Father Tim, all of that crowd. Now, the second chapter is Metagate, and that goes throughout the book. So they actually get equal time, the two families, because the young family is now a presence in our lives. We've watched them grow up. We've seen them come from very broken, shattered homes, and how they've gone to school and how they have worked hard and done well. And so I wanted to see how they grow. Now they have an adopted son, and I'm crazy about this kid. I mean, my daughter says, Mom, how do you write this little boy from the inside out? Like, I don't know. I don't really know much about little boys, but he just walked in, and there he was, and I'm just wild about him. So I want to show both families and how they interface and interact also. They're only 20 minutes from each other.
Yeah. And maybe it's just because I'm trying to decide why I think that has taken precedence, why that part of the story has taken precedence in my mind over Father Tim. Maybe,
well, Come Rain or Come Shine was about their wedding.
Yeah.
But Father Tim was a big player in that, because they moved out to the farm to be with the young people as they were getting it ready for the wedding.
You know, you talk about your writing and how things just come out. I'm wondering what is your writing style like? You probably get asked this all the time, but I'm curious.
What is my writing style like?
Well, how do you sit down and write for?
Well, you know, I just do what you just said. I just sit down and write. And I sit down even when I don't want to sit down and write. Because wonderful things can happen. You think, I tell you what, if you wrote only when you were so-called in the mood, you would not write much. You've got to put your fanny in a chair, no matter what. And what's so amazing, Larry, is when you do that, even though you don't want to be there, if you sit there and wait, it will come. Things, wonderful things happen when I don't want to write. Some of my best writing happens when I don't want to write. So I make sure that I try to be in the chair when I especially don't want to write.
So you just sit there, Jan?
Just sort of sit there and muse and pray. I pray a lot as I work through these novels. I really want God to give me the words, give me words for his people. I want to make my readers laugh. I want to make them cry. I want to assure them and reassure them that God really does love us. I mean, I have a need to do this, to accomplish this in my work. I got to tell you, if I can't do something like that, why bother?
Yeah.
Why bother?
Yeah. Kind of along that line, in some ways, I think Paula on Facebook says her stepmom and her both read your books, and after the stepmom passed away, reading the Midford series helps her feel connected to her stepmother, and says, thank you for such fun books, Jan.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate that. That means a lot.
Yeah, it must be gratifying to hear those kinds of words.
Always. I never tire of hearing how these books affect people. I mean, I hear the most extraordinary things. Like, for example, in two different cities, from two different young couples, they said to me, Miss Karen, I can't tell you how much we love your books. They have saved our marriage.
Wow.
And I'm like, as we say today, I'm like, I don't know how to do that. I don't have a clue. I couldn't even save my own. But here's the thing. When you pray, when you bathe any work in prayer, God is going to be in it. And so he knows how to do that stuff. I don't. And I don't even want to know. I don't even have to know. But the books I find are used in the most extraordinary, and I have to say, divine ways. They do things in the lives of people that I would never be able to imagine.
Yeah. And this is the last, you're sure this is the last in the series?
I really am sure. It's the 14th novel, and here's the deal, Larry. I don't want to give my reader something that is forced and artificial. I am not going to do that. I respect my readers, which is just one reason I don't use any cussing, any graphic sex, no murder, no mayhem. I respect my reader. If that's what they want, they can get it in plenty of places elsewhere. So I don't want to give them another book just because it would be more money for me and another book for them. That's not the way to do it. I'm stopping while I'm ahead.
Yeah.
I could probably go on, but I don't. My passion is leading me now to another place, and I really don't know where that place is. I'm taking several months off, and I've discussed it with my publisher, and they said, God bless Putnam, they said, we'll publish anything you write. Oh. I have a wonderful publisher, and so I'm satisfied to just wait. I want to do what comes to me and feels authentic.
Yeah. And you're going to take some time and think about that.
Yeah, I'm going to a little cottage in a warm place this winter. First time I've ever done anything like that. Really, all I've done is work for years. Just work all the time. That was just sort of what I did. And I think that I need a fresh spring You know, there's a whole aquifer down there, and I need to tap back into it and see what it brings. It could bring a historical novel. It could bring a collection of short stories. I just don't know, but I'm very excited to find out.
Yeah, and I tell you what, I bet your readers are going to be very excited to find out what you come up with.
Well, I hope they'll follow me and give me permission to follow my heart.
I think they will, Jan. I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. It was such a pleasure to speak with you, and I hope you had fun, too.
Thank you. You're a lovely man, Larry. You're a great interviewer. Thank you.
Jan Caron is our guest. She is a novelist who she writes for both adults and young readers, the author of the New York Times bestselling Mitford novel, a series of novels, 14 of them, featuring Father Timothy Cavanaugh, an Episcopal priest, and the fictional village of Mitford. And her latest in the series is titled To Be Where You Are, and it is on the New York Times bestseller list, just like her other books in that Mitford series have been as well. A lot of fun talking with her, Jan Caron, and I hope you have a chance to take a look at her book. It's titled To Be Where You Are. Fun talking with her. And you know what? It's going to be fun talking with our next guest as well, as we talk about the value of raising mentally strong children. And we'll find that out when we talk with the author of 13 Things Mentally Strong Parents Don't Do. How about that? I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network.